This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your usual host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you tuning in to Trumpet Hour today for our last episode of 2018. And our panel of trumpet writers have several prophetically significant stories rounded up today that they're anxious to discuss. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Greetings.
Joining us from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, 2018 has been a year of geopolitical transition. It's been a year of tensions building and global power shifting. This week, Geopolitical Futures wrote about the transition that's now underway, saying, quote, "We bookmark certain years in our memories. We remember 2008 for a financial crisis that nearly sank the global economy. We remember 1991 as the year the Cold War ended. We remember 1939 as the moment Nazi Germany began its quest for global domination. These years are important because they changed the world for generations to come, but they are no more important than the years that preceded them. For it was in these years that the social, economic, and political conditions that fomented change were created." So I wanted to bring attention to that really insightful analysis because 2018 has been one of those preceding years. It's been one of the years in which the conditions that later foment change were created. And several of our stories today really show that transition and those rising tensions in some fascinating detail. The first one really shows just how quickly the Middle East, an already very volatile region, is being destabilized. And it shows just how belligerent a regional power there is becoming. For this, we'll go to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
I'm really pleased that you just started the program like that. Obviously, I didn't know you were going to talk about just the moment of transition that we're in as far as geopolitics goes. But just this week, looking at the Middle East, I could have chosen, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 stories. None of them, I would say, are absolute blockbuster stories. But all of them are very all of them highlight the very destabilized nature of the Middle East and the very complicated nature of the Middle East right now, given there's so many foreign actors involved. Just before we came on the show, there was this, obviously everyone knows that America is pulling out of Syria right now. And the push for the land that the United States retreats from is increasing. You just had the Kurds. Looks like they're going to side with the Russians and the Syrians before the Turks come in to try and trounce them. That's not a story that I want to cover, but it just highlights how big world powers are making big moves in the Middle East right now. And especially that's going to happen with the United States withdrawal from the region. One place the United States is not withdrawing right now, the U.S. president said, is Iraq. He visited troops in Iraq at an Air Force base, U.S. troops in Iraq this week. He said the 5,000 U.S. forces in Iraq will stay there for the meantime. And he said in that speech that one reason that they're staying there is to keep an eye on Iran. And that is something that a lot of people are happy about because most people were disappointed with the United States retreat from Syria because of what Iran would do in the vacuum. And they still might fill that vacuum. But the president in America says that the U.S. forces in Iraq are going to put a hold on that, at least attempt to. And we saw just a classic example of that need this week as the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps started these military drills in the Strait of Hormuz, a really important strategic area that's just, I think it's about 19 or 18 miles across, where a third of world seaborne oil passes through. You had the return of the area of a U.S. aircraft carrier for the first time in about 8 months. There hasn't been an aircraft carrier for the U.S. been there in that amount of time, which is a goes back about 15 years, I guess, as far as the length of as far as a length of stay or a length of absence to counter that. But in the while this U.S. Aircraft carrier was coming in, Iran was doing these war games. Most of them took place on an island that's right in the middle of the close to the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf there. And these war games were serious. They were testing out a lot of their equipment, and basically they were showing, just as the U.S. entered back into the area, that no, actually, we have a lot of power inside the Persian Gulf. We can act on your forces if we see fit. They were testing out a lot of different new weaponry. One of these interesting things they were using was anti-helicopter mines. They used them for the first time. These are remote-controlled weapons that jump about 600 feet off the ground and explode in a crowd of shrapnel that disperses over 330 feet. So they're testing all of these weapons, and they are weapons that are meant to be used against the United States.
Wow. Yeah, it really sounds like it's, you know, almost becoming sort of a standoff of sorts, or just, you know, displays of power on both sides. Where do you think this is leading in the near term?
Well, I think obviously the Iranians at this moment know the U.S. is still a powerful force in the region, especially in the Persian Gulf. They have the naval base there, and now you have another aircraft carrier there. But they are showing that they're not scared to threaten U.S. forces. This operation was, as some of the commanders were talking about, how this was an offensive operation. While it's defensive in the fact that we're using offense so that we are show that we can defend ourselves. Normally they say they're just defensive games, but this time they said no, we need to be offensive to end up defending our interests, which was really interesting. It's the first time Iran has said that about their naval games.
And this wasn't the only place in the Middle East where we saw Iranian aggression on display this week.
Of course, yeah. Iran is at work everywhere they can be. And this week we saw Israel actually attack near Damascus an Iranian storage facility. This was storing weapons and logistical hardware that is going to help, that Iran is trying to give to Hezbollah, including GPS guidance systems. And Israel conducted a missile strike on that Tuesday night and basically leveled the whole building. In response, Syria fired a couple of missiles into Israel that ended up being shot down. And so Israel showed through this action that even though the United States is going to get out of Syria, that they are willing and able to act inside Syria against Iranian interests there. What's interesting, I think, just about the stepping back from this is to see that Israel used to not publish the fact that they were firing on Iranian forces or Syrian forces inside Syria. That has now changed. Netanyahu came out and said that, hey, we did this. The military came out and said that we did this. And so that's kind of highlighted the change as well. And also the fact that Syria can fire a missile into Israel and you hardly even hear anything about it anymore. 3 or 4 years ago, if this happened, it would be news. It would make Drudge Report. It would be big news, but it happens so regularly now. Israel going to Syria to stop Iran trying to take over there and then return fire coming back. Just another sign that the Middle East is just a powder keg right now.
If you were to summarize that powder keg that we see and just sort of place it in the context of Bible prophecy and why on Trumpet Hour we call so much attention to the Middle East, how would you go about that?
Yeah, well, it all gets back to the belligerent actor here, the offensive actor here, and that is Iran and its proxies that push everywhere across the Middle East, other actors, to defend themselves. And that's what you're seeing Israel doing. That's what you would see the United States doing right now if they were attacked. And so Bible prophecy really does talk about how Iran is going to lead a very pushy group of nations, Islamic nations, that are going to mobilize the rest of the Middle East to have to respond. They're going to mobilize nations outside the Middle East to have to respond to them. And this is what we see happening right now everywhere across the Middle East. Everywhere you have a zone of contention in the Middle East, you have an Iranian proxy or Iranian forces themselves causing it. And that is biblically prophesied. That is a biblically prophesied push that's going to lead the world to great war, huge world war. And so that's why it's significant. If people want to read more about that, they can do so by requesting our editor-in-chief's book, King of the South.
Well, thank you for that, Brent. It really looks like the situation there is primed for conflict. And our next story today is a somewhat related one, ideologically anyway. Just it's another one that really shows the stage being set for a clash of civilizations between the Catholics of Europe and Islamists. For this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
So starting next year, and by next year, I mean in like 3 days' time, if you want to become a Danish citizen, at the end of that citizenship ceremony, you will have to shake hands with the official at that ceremony. And if you refuse to shake hands, you cannot become a citizen. Now, there's more to this than simple handshaking and politeness. There's a deliberate target of this particular piece of legislation. You know, handshaking, yeah, it's something we all do very regularly in the West. However, certain more extreme or more devout, I don't know which way to put it, but Muslims do not want to shake hands with members of the opposite gender. Hmm. And so, you know, depending on who is officiating at that ceremony and what gender they are, they may not want to shake hands with them. So this particular law is, it's couched in very neutral language. Those legislating it are very careful to avoid mentioning any religion in particular when they lay it out, because that would open it up to human rights charges, etc. Mm-hmm. But it's very clear from the discussion going on around this that this is aimed at Muslims.
Right.
And this is just the latest in a whole trend of different kind of laws. So also Denmark, just in May of this year, 2018, they passed a law forbidding Muslims from wearing the niqab, the kind of the really full-on face veil, mm-hmm. in public. And Denmark, Germany, Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, they all have some kind of ban on these full-coloring face veils. Some, you know, they're a bit different in different countries, but some kind of ban in public places or public buildings. And again, these are often cased in more neutral language, like, well, all face coverings are forbidden, but it's clear who they're aiming at. It's these individuals that don't fit in with the prevailing culture. This handshake law, it's been controversial. There has been a lot on the left that have been very critical of it, but 52% of Danes said they disagree with the law. So it's a pretty divided country, but this is a European wide trend. And what this is, I think, is a very interesting reaction to the right to Muslim migration into Europe and radical Islam into Europe. It's a emphasis on, well, what makes us different from Muslims? What makes us different from these migrants? And in some cases, it's these secular things such as handshakes and not wearing face veils. But in other areas, it's to emphasize the Christian heritage of Europe. So, for example, Bavaria has a law that mandates that all public buildings have the cross on display. Something that's much more than, okay, well, what makes us different? Well, we're emphasizing those Christian symbols. And then you look at the rhetoric of those leaders that are generally characterized as populist, but some of the, you know, Viktor Orban in Hungary, and there's a lot more of them actually in power in Eastern Europe, the Law and Justice Party in Poland, but then also people like Le Pen and their new party that used to be the National Front. I can't remember that they changed the name to, but you know, in France, the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, where they really emphasize this Christian heritage and culture. And even the Christian Social Union in Germany follows this. And I think there was a sociologist at the University of California, Rogers Brubaker, that summarized this very well in The Atlantic last year, where he talked about this push. He called it a push for a secularized Christianity as a culture. And he wrote, it's a matter of belonging rather than believing. We are Christians precisely because they are Muslims. Otherwise, we are not Christian in any substantive sense. And so you get this very interesting trend in Europe where, on the one hand, church attendance is still declining, and you know, things like abortion and homosexual marriage are becoming more and more supported in law. But on the other hand, now Christian talking points, discussion, identity, symbols are becoming much more prominent in everyday life, as you see, and especially where they come in conflict with Islam. And you just see this reaction to Islam resulting in this public turning to Christianity.
Yeah, these you know, the handshake law and these other laws that you mentioned there, it really just shows the refusal of many Muslim immigrants to assimilate, and also that refusal to adopt European cultural norms is becoming something that the Europeans are less and less willing to tolerate. So you can see a lot of tension building there. Could you please place this in the context of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, well, like you said at the start, this really does tie in, especially when you bring in Bible prophecy, with the story Brent was talking about. So as he kind of talks about, Daniel chapter 11 describes this clash between a king of the north and the king of the south. And he was talking about the king of the south mostly in that, which is radical Islam led by Iran. The king of the north is this European conglomerate led by Germany. And then other prophecies, like Revelation 17 and Revelation 13, but other ones as well, tell us this European power is going to be ruled by a church. She's going to have a strong religious component and identity. And so then Daniel 11 talks about, well, this European power responding, having been pushed by radical Islam, this religious European power. And you see that dynamic, just like Brent was talking about. You see this dynamic already. You see radical Islam continually provoking Europe, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's Iran pushing sea gates, whether it's Muslims coming to Europe and refusing to assimilate, and even in some few cases carrying out terrorist attacks. And then you see Europe being roused. And part of that revival of Europe and being roused against radical Islam is in this more Christian identity opposed to Islam. And Daniel 11 describes this leading to a clash between the two, a violent clash between the two. And you can see part of that clash building in this, just the way that this religious clash is starting to grow within Europe. And our free book, The King of the South, will, you know, it will help you prove those identities that we've just mentioned briefly, and help you just really clearly go through that chapter at Daniel 11 and what it tells you about what's coming to Europe, because we really do see so much of what is prophesied. You can see that beginning to be fulfilled in so many different ways.
And we'll have a link to that King of the South booklet in the show notes for today's program, and you'll be able to find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Another big transition that continued during 2018 was seeing Asian nations that historically have had deep resentment toward each other begin to move more and more toward cooperation and toward alignment. To tell us about one significant instance of this, we'll go to Anthony Chibadidwe.
The South China Morning Post reported on Tuesday that the Japanese government is planning to send its maritime self-defense force vessels to China to participate in China's naval fleet review. This fleet review will be held on April 23rd of 2019. And that day marks the 70th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Navy. So it's a big deal, and Japan is planning to send its vessels over there. A Japanese government source said that Japan may also invite a Chinese warship to their own naval review, which will be held in the fall. Chinese destroyers and Japanese destroyers and warships have been making these mutual visits from 2007 to 2011, but the exchanges stopped over a dispute over the islands in the East China Sea, and so that this means that this will be the first time since 2011 that these nations are resuming these defense exchanges. Defense authorities of the two countries also started discussions on mutual visits of their defense ministers and other high officials. And in fact, in October, Shinzo Abe, the prime minister of Japan, visited Beijing, which was the first time a high-level Japanese official or the Prime Minister of Japan visited China in nearly seven years. And also at that meeting, the Chinese leader Xi Jinping also told the Japanese Prime Minister that he would seriously consider making a trip to Japan next year, 2019, and it will be the first visit by a Chinese leader in 11 years. So that's pretty remarkable. We're seeing all these new developments, these new changes, and we've written a lot about that. In December 10th, we had an article about the Japanese Navy and how it's building and expanding. And we noted that some of the reasons why Japan is expanding this way is because of the fears from North Korea and also its fears of Chinese expansion and Russia's military activity around Japan. And that might sound a little bit contradictory. We are talking about how Japan fears China's power in that region, and yet we are also seeing Japan and China cooperate. Well, what's significant about this is that even though there is this tension between the two countries, they do have issues that go back a long time, and they still have problems between each other, and yet you're seeing a thawing of the relationship between these countries. And this is significant because Bible prophecy indicates that they will put aside their differences and just use that cooperation to become a stronger power collectively. And what we're seeing today, I think it's remarkable in that even though they still have issues, they are still willing to cooperate to have these defense exchanges with each other. And that, I think, is far more significant, far more important than whatever small disputes that they might have now. And that's certainly what Bible prophecy indicates.
Could you let listeners know where they might go to learn more about those prophecies that you mentioned there?
Yeah, we do have a booklet that's titled Russia and China in Prophecy. And it talks a lot about Russia and China, but also Japan's involvement in this alliance. And it's not just those three countries. There are many other Asian countries involved in an end-time alliance that will make up a massive military. And that booklet discusses that in detail. And our listeners can also read an article titled Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be published there soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these very significant stories. In just a moment, we'll take a break, but first we'll discuss one more aspect of the transition and the shift in global power that picked up speed in 2018, and that is the deepening of the U.S.'s internal divisions. To tell us about the latest on this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, not much of substance is happening in the United States this week. The government has been in a partial shutdown for now's day seven, with nine federal departments and several government agencies being shut down. The reason is gridlock over the budget. Republicans and Democrats are still fighting over the coming year's spending bill. We're not able to get a spending bill passed by the deadline. And so now these nine departments aren't allowed to spend anything until a bill is passed.
Do you have a read on how soon that might happen, how soon a bill could be passed and the gridlock could end?
Well, definitely not till the weekend's over by now. Probably not till after the first of the year. The main point of contention is President Trump and the Republicans have really stood their ground in that they're not allowing this bill to pass until they get $5 billion for a border wall this year, which, of course, the Democrats have taken the opposite position, is that there will be no $5 billion for the border wall, and so neither side will give way until some sort of compromise is reached, or one side eventually does have to capitulate to whether we're building that wall or not, which highlights a couple Bible prophecies that we bring up on this program often. There's the one in Isaiah 1 and verse 5, where we've talked before, where this is God talking about how his people have turned away from him. And so verse 5 says, "And why should you be stricken anymore? Why will you revolt more and more? The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint." In our Isaiah booklet by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, it points out that sickness and the faintness, the head of anything is its governing organ. Right. So the head of the United States is the United States government. You're talking about the government is sick, the government is faint, the government can't make decisions because of this internal gridlock. And then another prophecy in Deuteronomy 28, verses 52, again, God talking about curses that come on his people if they disobey him, where he says, "You shall be besieged in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trusted throughout all the land." It's another one in the book Great Again, also by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. He talks about this, this besiegement of Israel, the high and fenced walls that you're trusting, even trusting more than we trust God, to protect us from drug cartels and foreign invaders and criminals and other people from Latin America are going to come down. So the idea that the government shut down over a fight over border walls just really illustrates both of these, that the head is sick and the walls and the border security that Americans are trusting to defend them are being systematically torn down because of their rebellion against God.
Yeah, the one about the high walls coming down really makes it sound like either an effective wall won't be built or that it won't be effective at keeping some of those destructive elements out of the country there. Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type KPCG FM into your internet browser. Coming up, we'll talk about the German military considering recruiting EU citizens, an early election called in Israel, anti-Semitism in American politics, and a devastating tsunami in Indonesia. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and our next story is about the German military considering casting a wider net to fill its ranks. To bring us up to speed on the latest developments here, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so the Inspector General of the Bundeswehr, that's the most senior, basically, member in the German army, he mentioned that they'd floated the option of recruiting other members from other EU nations into the German army, which, if they did this, would be a pretty major break for the way the German army works. You know, they've, ever since the Second World War, they've really put a lot of emphasis on having, you know, what's called citizen soldiers, so that you don't have this kind of where soldiers are almost like this class apart, separate and distinct from their fellow citizens, but just that it, you know, that it very naturally reflects the German people. And this was a part of the thinking behind conscription, and this is part of the reason why there was such a lot of debate when Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg ended conscription. They were worried this would be a step back potentially to this having a class of professional soldiers. This is potentially another step, and it's, like I said, yeah, one that then has created a lot of debate and controversy. They've said that for now they're just looking at filling specialist positions like doctors and IT professionalists. But this is, I mean, this is what happens when you go from being a conscription army, I guess, to a professional army. And we've seen a whole load of changes in the German army and even German society in the way it interacts with the armed forces since Gutenberg made that decision when he was defense minister. So, for example, if you're recruiting, well, Now you've got to persuade people to join up. Now you've got to have TV adverts persuading people that the army's awesome. Now you've got to get soldiers going into schools, extolling the benefits of serving in the army, talking about military glory, potentially even talking about Germany's glorious military past, as some are starting to do. You then have things like there's a very popular YouTube series going on within Germany where they follow some soldiers as they go through the army, but it's an attempt at recruitment. So they've been doing this, but they're still short soldiers. And so now they're looking at, well, can we start to get people in from other European countries, and can they serve in our army as well?
So these are not the only potential soldiers serving under German command. Already there have been some European nations that have partly assimilated their forces into the Berlin-led structure there. Could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, so a few nations have been hitting a problem. You know, we want to have tanks to defend ourselves, but we don't really have the money to pay for them. And they've come up with the idea of, well, I know, let's have all of our tank soldiers move into the German army. And they can be under German command, but then they still, you know, they still get to work, live and work on their bases in our countries, and they'll defend us if push comes to shove. And so the Netherlands have gone down this route where you've now got to the point where roughly 2/3 of their ground force and definitely 2/3 of their command structure are actually literally in the German army. And they've just about finished integrating. So they're now part of German panzer divisions with a German commander over the top of them, and then, you know, Dutch troops under that, and they're used to serving alongside the German army. As this started to happen, the Czech and the Romanians got interested for the similar reasons, and so now you've got a significant, very significant chunk. You're talking about kind of, you know, at least in terms of command structures, half the mechanized infantry or half the tank forces. It's to both mechanized brigades in both places, but half of them in the German army under German command, and they're still in the process of moving over. You've got Poland has at times kind of blown hot and cold over this idea, but they've talked about doing something similar, bringing some of their soldiers or potentially even some of their navy under German command in return for some German cash and support in helping them. And the German defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, has even talked about perhaps by 2020 getting up a multinational panzer division going. They really are doing a lot of very concrete things to build a European military in really practical ways. I think France kind of steals the limelight in terms of talking about it, but no one else has done anything quite like this. There are other brigades. There's the Franco-German brigade, but they tend to be more symbolic. You know, when they deployed, they split up into their French and into their German sides, whereas this is much more of an organic union between these different nations. And so then having almost, say, French Foreign Legion-style ways for European soldiers to come and serve in Germany. And I think if they went down this route, you know, having just saying it's professionals, just maybe limiting it to IT and healthcare, that would be the thin end of the wedge. And you'd very quickly see this opened up to other areas. But you know, that would just be a continuation of this trend that really is seeing the German army begin to transform itself into a European army.
So the German military and broader European moves toward establishing an EU military are something that we discuss quite often on the Trumpet Hour. Could you just tell listeners why that is and what they could read if they wanted to understand more about the broader trends there?
Yes. Yeah, so this is the Bible talks about in Revelation chapter 17, it has a picture of 10 kings, 10 kings that it says that for 1 hour. So they're all these 10 kings are at the same time. And for 1 hour, they give their strength and power into what this chapter calls the beast. But you know, you read around that, and it's very clear that this is referring to almost like an empire, you know, a major world power. So these 10 kings, they give their strength and their power over to this major world power. So, and they work together very closely. So what that means is, and what Herbert W. Armstrong was saying and writing all the way back in the 1940s even, is that you're going to have 10 kings that, you know, they have some kind of combined military force. Their armies work together, coordinate together, conquer together. And so right from the end of World War II, Herbert Armstrong said, you watch in Europe, there's going to be a kind of European Union. His words exactly, European Union. And it's going to be said it's going to begin as an economic power. And eventually it's going to move into to more economic, to monetary, to political, and even military union. They're going to combine their forces. And it's because of those scriptures in Revelation chapter 17. And a great place to read more about this would be the Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory's cover article from the latest Trumpet print edition, and just went to print this week. And it's up on our website right now, just gone up there. The cover picture is Macron versus Trump. The cover story is France rejects America and empowers Germany. And there's a good chunk in there that talks about how France is empowering Germany on a military level, on the military projects that France and Germany are working with together, and what the Bible says about this combined military power that's coming in Europe. So that will give you a bit of a different angle on this growing military power and the up-to-date biblical analysis of what's happening here.
Yes, that is a very powerful cover story that we have there, so we'll be sure to include a link to that. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, back to Israel now, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is suddenly facing what some are calling the greatest test of his career. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to our Jerusalem office and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, about a month and a half ago, we thought that Israel might be going to early elections just because the defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, resigned over the way that Netanyahu handled the Gaza crisis when Hamas was firing all those rockets into Israel. But we didn't have to go to early elections because the coalition didn't break down completely, and Netanyahu right now holds a 61-60 majority, his coalition in the Knesset. And so 61 seats to 60, so he can still get things done. However, there is a bigger cloud hovering over the prime ministership of Mr. Netanyahu now, which has caused him, it looks like, to go to elections in April 9th. You have three cases against Mr. Netanyahu that are at the Supreme Court, well, that the Attorney General is going to have to decide on whether he's going to indict the Prime Minister. A couple of them look pretty serious for bribery. And so it looked like he would just be indicted for something a little bit less than that. And just because you get indicted by the Attorney General, you can still stay in power. But the last couple of days, there was reports that it might be even more serious than that, than it might be bribery. He'll be pinged for recommended indictment over bribery, which is a very serious offense. And so that's caused, it seems, Prime Minister Netanyahu to go to elections sooner rather than later so that he can have elections before the recommendation of the Attorney General come down. And so right now you have in Israel a very fragmented political situation. I mean, it's always been that way because they've got a multi-party system. You vote for a party, you don't vote for a president, and then whoever has the most votes or most seats in that election, which party has the opportunity to try and form a coalition to make a majority government. And Netanyahu has done that. And so it looks like he's going to try and get in before the indictment comes down from the Attorney General, just in case it is the case of bribery, and then it looks like he might not be able to win the election. If we went to elections right now, it looks like Netanyahu's Likud party would still win the most seats and he would still be able to form the majority, which is probably why he's doing it. But we just had a new contender come onto the political field here, Benny Gantz. He's the former IDF chief of staff. He said on Thursday, or at least he leaked to the press on Thursday, that he is going to start a new political party in Israel. And he is probably centrist, center-left. And so Netanyahu isn't necessarily worried that he's going to eat the center-right seats. Nevertheless, this is an extremely popular figure that looks like could be the opposition leader, and or if he comes out and actually tells us what he's going to, his platform is, he might take some votes away from Netanyahu. But this is really just, I mean, it just highlights what happens behind the scenes. Israel's surrounded by all these enemies. Israel's faced by an incredible security threat, security risk, and there is so much internal fighting. Deliberations amongst political parties. It's a fragmented political system. Netanyahu still might come on top, but it's not the kind of strength that you feel is needed in a time like this.
What's your read on these charges against him? Do you feel like there's validity to them, or are they just trumped up?
Trumped up, nice. Well, Mr. Netanyahu has claimed that he has been attacked in a similar way that Mr. Trump has. And I would say that there's probably a little bit of that. It does look like, though, that there might have been a couple of decisions that were made that were against the law. One of them relates to just receiving large gifts, him and his wife, from other people. Obviously, you can't do that if you're in a position of power. And the other couple are kind of serious as well. So I don't know. I mean, most Israelis, they might be like, well, so what? Yeah, he might have done these things, but man, we feel safe with his prime ministership. I mean, he's almost right now the longest tenured prime minister in Israel's history. David Ben-Gurion, the very first prime minister, is slightly longer than him. In Israel's political system, you can basically keep on being prime minister if your party keeps on being voted in. And so he might just win on the security factor alone. Nevertheless, I think these charges are serious, and they're just not what the Strait of Israel needs right now, to have this cloud of uncertainty hovering over the nation.
And is there any literature that you'd like to point listeners to if they'd like to know more about this?
Well, in terms of Bible prophecy, we have pointed to the fact that it does seem that Israel is going to be led by a strong leader, someone that is strong in defense, all the way up until events plunge into the precursors to World War III or the Great Tribulation. And so we have said that somebody like Mr. Netanyahu is likely going to continue in power. And so we definitely do hold true to that still. And if people want to understand more of the reasoning behind that, they can go ahead and request our editor-in-chief's book, Jerusalem and Prophecy.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. Israel's staunchest ally for decades has been the United States, and really the U.S. has been the major guarantor of Israel's survival in many ways. But some U.S. politicians have no affection at all for the Jewish nation and actually seem to long for its destruction. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Democratic Party has been shifting in a more anti-Israel, some would even say anti-Semitic direction for a number of years now. The trends definitely escalated over the past few months in the November midterm elections, with three new representatives being elected who are very outspoken against the Jewish state, calling it an apartheid regime, and just demanding unabashedly, no nuance whatsoever, that the Palestinians are the good guys, the Israelis are evil. Mm-hmm. That is obviously the much talked about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has demanded that Israel stop its occupation of Palestine, and then when pressured on what she meant, say she's not a geopolitical expert on the issue, which indicates she may just have no clue what the world she's talking about. But then the other two, they've had the first two Muslim congresswomen elected in American history. Rashida Tlaib, who's a Palestinian-American, and Ilha Omar, who's Somali-American, who've both come out, in Omar's case, demanding, calling Israel an evil country run by an apartheid regime. And so even though these three are the most outspoken, their remarks have not been condemned or contradicted by anyone in the Democratic Party.
Wow.
And on the other side, even more of the, I guess, so-called moderate Democrats have definitely taken the side of the Palestinians in this conflict, showing very little nuance or towards the complicated issues of solving this Middle Eastern peace process, which is pointing towards a very sobering Bible prophecy we've mentioned on this program a few times before. In Zechariah 11, verse 14, where God says, "I will cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel."
Hmm.
And now we've talked before that, I mean, most people know that Judah is one of the 12 tribes of Israel, the one that the Jews come from, and the Jews live in the nation in the Middle East called Israel.
Right.
Those familiar with the late Herbert W. Armstrong's books, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, knows that there were 10 other tribes of Israel that were taken into captivity by Assyria anciently, and taken captives into Europe, where they became the ancestors of the modern-day American and British peoples. So when it's talking about breaking the brotherhood between Judah and Israel, it's talking about breaking the brotherhood between the nation in the Middle East called Israel and America and Britain as well.
Right.
And that's a prophecy that we definitely saw under the Obama administration, that brotherhood come under intense strain. Under the Trump administration, with moving the embassy to Jerusalem, the Republican Party being in power, there's kind of been a temporary revival of that brotherhood. But the underlying tensions and the underlying gridlock and divisions in America that make America a very unstable ally for Israel are still there, as Israeli leaders wonder which side of Congress is going to win out on any given issue. And that is just leading to that time when that brotherhood will be broken and the Jewish people will be on their own.
We will be sure to include a link to Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, in the show notes. We're also in the process of doing the final stages of a full-length documentary based on the information in that very powerful book. So we'll have updates on that in the weeks and months ahead. On Trumpet Hour, I'm sure. Well, 2018 was also a very notable year for weather disasters, with record fires in California, record hurricanes in Florida and the Carolinas, a super typhoon around the Philippines and southern China. And then when it looked like that was all for the year, Indonesia was just hit by a devastating disaster. To tell us about this, we'll go to Anthony Chibadiwe.
Yes, that tsunami did dominate Asia news this week, and it's obviously a subject that a lot of people do get concerned about, and it certainly does warrant a clear biblical perspective. But first, let's get a little bit into the details. A tsunami was triggered by a volcanic island known as Anak Krakatau. And there was a volcanic eruption there this past Saturday. And scientists have confirmed that the volcano triggered an underwater landslide, which in turn generated this tsunami, this massive killer wave that reached at least 3 coastal towns and caused devastating damage. Buildings were demolished, trees were uprooted, cars were swept away, and more importantly, precious lives were destroyed. At least 426 people are confirmed dead, and that includes members of a rock band that was videotaped performing right up until the moment that the waves hit. At least 159 people are missing, and that includes a 5-year-old girl who was swept away from her mother's hands when the waves just hit them. More than 1,400 have been injured. Tens of thousands have been displaced. Flights have been diverted from the area because the volcano was just spewing out clouds of ash. And just yesterday, authorities raised the threat levels to the second highest level because they were fearing a second tsunami. So at least people were getting warnings. People are getting warnings now because they largely didn't get any before Saturday's tsunami. There was one report that actually said that local authorities initially assured people that there was no tsunami risk, and they told locals not to panic or spread any fake news via social media. So when the tsunami actually did hit, a lot of people were not expecting it. So hence the destruction that happened. Now, the technology that India has to try to predict these tsunamis failed to detect the volcano-induced landslide that caused this tsunami. And so I guess some of the questions that people need to be asking are, what if more of this type of technology fails to predict future disasters? And what is causing all these disasters in the first place? Are carbon emissions causing volcanoes and tsunamis? Did fracking cause this particular tragedy? I put it this way because, you know, when disasters like this happen, people tend to look for answers in every possible place except the Bible. And thankfully, the Bible does have answers about the cause of these weather disasters. We have a booklet that's titled Why Natural Disasters, and it has natural in quotes there. And we recently updated the booklet, and we highly recommend our listeners to get it, because it does explain the biblical perspective surrounding all these events. It says here on page 24, the Bible shows that God permits Satan the devil to interfere with weather patterns and to have a role in producing catastrophic weather. And it also talks about God just being in full control of weather patterns. He says in the Bible that he controls the weather. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and on the unjust. And he sends snow and ice as well as drought and heat. So he allows Satan to interfere with the weather. And he also has the power to prevent any of those tragedies from happening. And sometimes he can even directly cause some of those disasters. When you look at Indonesia, this year has been particularly bad. I think some reports say that it's been the worst disaster in 10 years. It has been the worst year for Indonesia in 10 years. There have been 2,000 natural disasters just in this year alone, and those disasters have killed more than or nearly 4,000 people. And they say it's the worst disaster in 10 years because it hasn't surpassed the one from 2004, and that was the tsunami that killed more than 200,000 people in Asia, and about 130,000 of those people were in Indonesia alone. Indonesia is really prone to a lot of these disasters, and there's a certain complacency, I guess, that can come just with knowing that, well, this happens a lot in Indonesia. But God says in the Bible that he can prevent a lot of those. And our booklet, Why Natural Disasters, explains why they happen in the first place. And it also explains how God can prevent those natural disasters and how he can protect us individually when they do strike.
Well, that is really heartbreaking to hear about the devastation there, Anthony, but we thank you for bringing us up to speed on that and for showing us the hope that's also tied into it. Well, that brings us to the end of Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories we're discussing today and to subscribe to our free print edition and our free news brief, which we send out several times each week. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Always good to be here.
Been a pleasure.
Have a good weekend.
Always great to be here.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with another quote, quite a sobering quote, from the Geopolitical Futures article that we started with. The coming year, 2019, can best be described as a year on edge, a transition between the post-Cold War era and a new era that has yet to be defined. It will be a year when pent-up forces and countless events take us past the point of no return. It'll be a year of anxiety, suspicion, and fear of what the future holds as countries seek to delay the onset of crises they cannot avoid. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG. And on the web at kpcg.fm.